90s ESPN.
Yes.
About football today.
From Scouts Inc. Here's Jeremy Green.
Not today. This is still your producer slash host, Jay Soderberg, joined by guest slash host, Matt Williamson from Scouts Inc. Matt, how are you?
I am dynamite. How you doing, buddy?
We're still wishing Jeremy Green the best.
Absolutely.
Hopefully he'll be back soon, but he's not back today. So you're stuck with us, the insignificant moderator and the guest host on the phone.
Not on this show, buddy. I need you.
We got a lot to talk about. There's been a lot of signings since we've last had a show, and a lot of emails, too, sent to footballtoday at espnradio.com. So we're going to get to those today. It's just me and Matt. Let's see how it goes. We're hitting the quick slants.
Quick slants.
A couple of non-on-the-field sort of stories first to discuss with this one from the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, 49ers GM Scott McLuhan considering stepping down.
Yeah, that comes as a shock to me. I mean, I don't know him personally or know what his reasoning is behind that, but, I mean, you got to look at the Niners just on the field. They were a nightmare. I mean, just a couple of years ago, they were as bad as an organization as there was in the game, and now I think they're right in contention for, you know, winning their division. So, assuming that he's, you know, has as much say as everyone thinks he does, I think he's done a pretty good job.
Yeah, in my humble opinion, I think the 49ers are the team to beat in that division right now.
Yeah, I think the draft will tell us a lot, you know, because they do have the two first-round picks, but I think the draft sets up really well for them, too, is, hey, if they can get an offensive tackle with one of their first-rounders, their other needs aren't huge, that they could be one of those teams that can take a luxury pick, take a C.J. Spiller or, you know, a receiver that falls or something you don't see as a need that can make an instant impact.
Quick slants.
Our next story involves the Jets and the Giants. I've got an interesting take on this, but I'll save it. I want to hear what your take is on this. The Jets are going to open up the new stadium on Monday Night Football against an opponent still to be determined. But the Giants will actually open the stadium a day earlier after they won a coin flip to determine who would get the first regular season game in the new stadium. The coin flip was done by the commissioner, Roger Goodell. Woody Johnson, the Jets owner, had some things to say about it. He wasn't too happy about it. He sort of apologized today for his comments. What do you think of all this?
I don't know what there is to complain about. I mean, what's so terrible about a coin flip? Is one organization better than the other or more deserving than the other? I haven't done a lot of homework on this. I mean, I've been watching players and that kind of thing, but to me, a coin flip's as fair as anything else.
According, I guess also after this, whether it was done on purpose or not, but the New York Daily News is reporting the Jets are going to host a game on Thanksgiving night as well. Maybe a sort of consolation for not being the first game
in
the new Meadowlands.
That sounds like a good B prize, you know? I don't have a problem with the whole situation.
Here's my take on it. A, why are you still sharing a stadium? And B, it was the Giants stadium first. I don't understand what you're complaining about. Jets fans, if you got a problem with it, go build your own stadium. I mean, that's my take on the whole thing. It's like, dude, go get your own stadium instead of sharing one with, you know, the team upstate.
Yeah,
because,
yeah,
you know, you're really the New Jersey Jets. Whatever. That's my take on the whole thing.
Quick slants.
NFL owners are going to vote on this new playoff overtime format. They will vote next week on whether to allow each team a possession in overtime in the playoffs if the team winning the coin toss kicks a field goal on the first series. If the team that falls behind by 3 points on the first series also kicks a field goal, then the game would continue under current sudden-death rules. The proposal will only be for the postseason.
I like it. I mean, the thing I like the most, the rule change that I would like the most, which is pretty much says the same thing, is you need 6 points in overtime to win.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's more or less the same ruling. It's just different wording.
Right.
And to me, that's the best way to do it. I don't love that it comes down to a coin flip. You get, you know, a nice return. You get 20 yards, kick the field goal. Everybody goes home 30 seconds later. But I know your points on it, too, are, well, hey, those guys on defense get paid, too, and they're equally as important. And I think that's valid as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's my whole thing. It's just, you know, I know people seem to think that it comes down to a coin flip, and it doesn't. I don't have the actual stats in front of me. But I've read recently that it's not as lopsided as one is perceived to believe. I don't know. whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that there's a great solution out there, though.
And I mean, if their overall goal is to try to get these games to end because of TV, well, you're just extending the game. Again, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense for what you're trying to accomplish.
For the playoffs, though, I don't think that they're as worried about it. You know, there's a little bit That's more true. Of a gap between there and the next game, and I think on a typical Sunday, they're a little more concerned about, let's get these guys off so we can get the 4 o'clock games going or whatever. But playoffs, they need to worry more about on-the-field product than the TV.
Playoffs?
They should be worried about getting a season started for 2011.
Quick slant.
Throw another little political commentary in before you can get another word in edgewise. We had some quarterback movement in the past week and a half or so. From the Browns, they agreed to a deal with quarterback Jake Delhomme. In ESPN NFL insider Adam Schefter is reporting that he's scheduled to make $7 million this season from Cleveland, including just under $900,000 in base salary, according to a source. With $12.7 million from Carolina, Delhomme will make $19.7 million this season, which technically would make him the highest-paid quarterback in the NFL. In the same week that they traded for Seneca Wallace, they came to this agreement with Delhomme. Delhomme's agent Rick Smith said the 35-year-old quarterback would sign his contract before the club's off-season conditioning program begins. A team spokesman said the Browns have no announcements planned. Delhomme has also said that he chose the Browns for his chance to start, which is also interesting because the Browns ended up releasing Derek Anderson and trading Brady Quinn to the Broncos.
This one doesn't add up to me. And I understand not liking Derek Anderson. I don't like Derek Anderson. I don't want him on my team. I want to play against him. I can see not liking Brady Quinn. I don't think he fits the West Coast system. I'm not sure he fits any system, although I think that's a very good pickup for Denver, considering they had very little invested to get him. But to bring in Delhomme, that one doesn't add up to me at all. He hasn't played well in, what, a year and a half, something like that? And all the interceptions, maybe he's a tremendous locker room guy, leader. I do think he's well-respected. That's great. But I thought Seneca Wallace was going to be the bridge quarterback, and I thought he was going to be a very good one because he is extremely familiar with the Holmgren system. You know, he's familiar with Holmgren from Seattle. That was a nice get. You get Seneca Wallace, it's much like A.J. Feely in St. Louis, and he paves the way for the short term until the young guy, whoever that might be, is ready. But to throw Delhomme into the mix just seems like it's going to retard the development of somebody. You're either not getting enough Wallace, or what does Delhomme bring to the table except for maybe some off-the-field leadership qualities, which I understand, but I don't want him taking snaps. I don't get that move at all. And in the end, I can see not loving Quinn, but wouldn't you rather have Wallace and Quinn than Wallace and Delhomme? Just because a year from now you might say, wow, Brady Quinn's a little bit better than I thought he was. I don't think we're ever going to say that about Delhomme anymore.
Well, you might also be saying it's going to be Wallace, Delhomme, and Sam Bradford, as a report says the Browns would consider trading up to take Sam Bradford.
Or maybe stay pat and get Clawson. I mean, I understand those things. That's plausible. And I think no matter what, they will draft someone. I don't think you can go into the year just with those two. Or, you know, maybe you take a kid in the third round or so, see how he develops, and realize that this is a huge project. You know, Holmgren has all the job security in the world. Mangini probably doesn't. That, hey, we're going to pick at the top of the draft again next year. Maybe you get a Ryan Mallett or a Jake Locker or something like that, too. But in the meantime, what are you really gaining at the quarterback position? That's why I think I would have kept Quinn, although I'm not a fan of his. He's done very little for me to get excited about him, but I at least think there's upside pedigree there. He's young as opposed to Delhomme.
Quick slants.
Before we get to Quinn, let's talk about Derek Anderson, who was released. After his release, he then went off and said Browns fans are, quote, ruthless and don't deserve a winner. Remembering the time when the Browns fans apparently booed him after he got injured. He then signed a 2-year deal with the Cardinals. What do you make of this?
Well, I spent a year in Cleveland, and it wasn't a particularly productive year on the field, but that's sort of the trend there since they've been back in the league. I respect the Cleveland fans. I think they're very strong. They're very passionate. And in a way, I really feel bad for them because they've been treated wrong, man. They've really gotten a raw deal. That year after year, they rebuild, all the shuffling within the organization, so little stability. Yeah, what do you hang your hat on? I mean, they've changed systems so many times. It's got to be awfully tough to be a Browns fan. And you know so many of these guys going to the stadium are generational fans. Their dads, their grandfathers, you know, they followed Jim Brown and great, great teams and a strong organization. And to go through what they've gone through since the expansion is a shame. And I don't think Derek Anderson has any legs to stand on whatsoever with his comments. And personally, I'm not a fan of him as a quarterback either. I don't really understand the signing in Arizona. He runs very hot and cold, and maybe he does get hot with that receiving core, and guys like Larry Fitzgerald can make you look a lot better than you are. He's not the most accurate quarterback around. And when Anderson had his best year, he was throwing to king-size guys. He was throwing to Winslow, Braylon, when they were all clicking together. He wasn't throwing to a bunch of little guys. So I don't think he's the most accurate drop-it-in-a-bucket type of quarterback. But, boy, when he's cold, he's horrendous. And he's cold a lot. And he doesn't get out of the pocket well. There's very little that I like about him as a quarterback, to be very honest with you. And I think the Cardinals could do better.
Well, before you pencil him in as the starter, Ken Wisenhunt came out and said that Matt Leiner is ready to take the reins as the starting quarterback.
I would hope so. I mean, if he can't beat out Derek Anderson, there's major problems with Leiner. I think Leiner's gotten a little bit of a bum rap. I think he can be productive in that system because he does throw with good touch. I'm not a big fan of him, don't get me wrong, but he throws with good touch. They do a lot of crossing routes and get the ball out. I think he can be accurate there. He doesn't get the ball out real quick. But Anderson's much different to me. Anderson takes a while to get rid of it. He's a much better downfield passer, bigger thrower. But if Leiner can't beat him out, then there's major problems there.
Do these offensive line signings in Arizona help them at all? Rex Hadnott, Ben Claxton?
Claxton's a nobody, in my opinion. I like Hadnott quite a bit. He could be a center or a guard. Short, wide body, run-blocking type that sort of, like all their offensive line acquisitions the last couple years, is really showing that they're going to be probably more of a run-first team now. You know, Beanie Wells, old-school Steeler football where Grimm and Wisenhunt came from. And obviously Grimm's a hog from back from his Washington days, and they know a little bit about running the football, and I think they're going to really lean that direction, and the Hadnott signing implies that even further.
Quick slant.
All right, to the Broncos now, who confirmed they acquired Brady Quinn from Cleveland for running back Peyton Hillis, a sixth-round pick in 2011 and a conditional pick in 2012. The teams announced the trade Sunday, said the deal is pending physicals. Upon acquiring Brady Quinn, they also released Chris Sims. So now it's Brady Quinn versus Kyle Orton. What do you think happens there?
I think Orton wins this one pretty clearly, but I mentioned I'm not a big fan of Quinn. He hasn't done a lot to impress me. Those things are very true. But this is a good situation for him because there's some overlap there, you know, from Quinn to Weiss to McDaniel. There's some Patriot connections. I think he will grasp the system quickly. You know, I don't like him as a West Coast passer because he isn't a real quick decision maker. I don't like him as a deep thrower because he's very hesitant to let the deep ball go and isn't accurate deep. In fact, he's not really accurate at all levels, which is a problem and doesn't make him a great fit for any system. But in a way, he's also sort of like Kyle Orton, too. Kyle Orton didn't take many chances. You know, they rarely threw the ball deep downfield. And I don't think he's as good as Orton. But for what they gave up, which I think is next to nothing, if he turns into a quality number two, which I don't think is far-fetched, then they got the better end of the deal.
Quick slants.
The Seahawks, according to ESPN's John Clayton, are the team that will win the services of third-string quarterback Charlie Whitehurst. The Seahawks will swap picks in the second round and will send the Chargers a third-round pick in 2011, according to multiple sources. According to a different source, the Seahawks, once the deal is complete, will sign Whitehurst to a two-year deal that will be worth $10 million. What's the deal with Charlie Whitehurst?
I think everybody wants to know that. And, you know, Mike Sando called me yesterday and asked the same thing. He's like, what's up with this guy? Why are people banging down his door? Well, he was a third-round pick for a reason. You know, he's a tall, prototypical build, good arm, quick release, reasonably smart, good decision maker. That is coming out of Clemson, and that was a while ago. I think that was like 6 years ago. So, but since then, I don't know that he's thrown an NFL pass in a live game. So there really isn't a whole lot to go on when you evaluate him. Everyone wants to say, is he the next Matt Schaub? You know, the backup quarterback who comes in and lights it up for a new team. Maybe, but I'm not going to base my reputation on that because I haven't seen a lot. But in his favor, you have to realize he's been sitting in the meeting room. He's a third-string quarterback. He's been sitting in the meeting room year after year with North Turner, who is exceptional with developing quarterbacks, Philip Rivers, who is as good as there is pretty much in the league, and Billy Volek, who's a journeyman in a way, but he's a veteran who's been around the block. And Whitehurst has been decent in the preseason. He throws the football well enough. You know, he wasn't a real big strapping guy coming out of Clemson, but I guess he's added a little bit of weight, strength, ability to take a hit, maybe put a little more on his fastball. So it's a huge risk, although you don't have that much involved in him. Who's to say if he's going to be the answer? But there are some promising signs there.
In interest of accuracy, the story updated, Seattle has signed Whitehurst to a two-year, $8 million deal with $2 million more in incentives.
It seems a little pricey, but, you know, quarterbacks are hard to get a hold of, and it's also a glaring sign that it's a quarterback-starved league.
I mean, we're also assuming he's the backup here to Mr. Hasselbeck.
I would imagine, you know, but Hasselbeck's been brittle. They don't have a great offensive line. They know they're not winning the Super Bowl this year, and they need to build for the long term. So who's to say that they don't have a pressing quarterback need again a year from now? But it's a reasonably good risk, in my opinion.
Quick slants.
Just to stick with the quarterback theme here, the Lions have acquired quarterback Sean Hill from the 49ers for a seventh-round pick, according to the Sacramento Bee.
I like this, too. He's been successful from a win-loss percentage, and obviously that's not all him. I mean, I think quarterbacks' win-loss percentage can get a little overblown, but he's been effective in this league. They desperately needed a number two. Stafford had injury problems last year, and Hill's been around the block a little bit. Maybe he can help coach him up. So they didn't give anything up for him once again, so why not?
Quick slants.
Moving on to running backs, and we'll start with LaDainian Tomlinson, who agrees to a two-year deal with the Jets. Tom Gondon said the Jets signed the former Chargers running back to a two-year contract. The Jets confirmed they've agreed to a deal, adding the aging starter to the NFL's top-ranked rushing offense last season. The 2006 NFL MVP, cut last month by San Diego, chose New York over Minnesota after visiting with the Vikings on Thursday of last week. Tomlinson spent Friday with the Jets, capping it with dinner with Coach Rex Ryan, General Manager Mike Tannenbaum, and other team officials. Tomlinson turns 31 in June. His deal is worth about $5.2 million. Adam Schefter notes that an escalator could boost his contract to $5.6 million, according to a source.
I'm not a huge fan of this. I would rather have Thomas Jones, personally. I think Jones has more in the tank. You know, I've been bashing Tomlinson now for well over a year. I think he is done. I thought he was done a year ago. That being said, you know,
he's backing up Sean Green, I'm assuming, here.
I would imagine. But, you know, on first down, I would rather hand the ball to Sean Green. On third down, I would rather get the ball to Leon Washington. So how many times is he really going to get in the game? I do think they need somebody to spell Green. Green was a one-year starter at Iowa. I'm not sold that he can be a 16-game plus playoffs plus preseason type of guy. But I thought Jones was perfect for that role. And, you know, Tomlinson does bring a little bit to the table as a receiver, although I think those skills are overblown at this point. He really had a hard time getting away from people last year. And I think he's a great goal line back. So I think he'll vulture a lot of touchdowns, probably end up with 5-6 carries right in that neighborhood a game, a catch here and there. But in the end, I don't think his jersey gets dirty all that much unless somebody gets hurt. And I don't want him to be my bell cow back. I think he can be, you know, his yards per carry should increase, but that's based on their line. I think they have the best run-blocking line in the league, where San Diego's was poor, you know, poor to maybe average on a good day. But I think Tomlinson only averaged like 3.3 yards a carry. I mean, that's really poor. And, you know, the Tomlinson of old, I don't care what the blocking was, never would have been that low. He doesn't have any big playability anymore. He doesn't run away from anyone. I mean, he maybe had a handful of highlight runs last year where, you know, years gone by, he's had 30, 40, you know, that you're really excited and make your jaw drop. I just don't think he, you know, is anywhere close to where he once was. But you got to think he's very hungry for a ring. He's going to come in and hopefully bring a good attitude and a hunger and teach Sean Green what it's like to be a professional running back at this level, how to take hits, how to value the football, how to keep your body, you know, equipped for all those games. So, I don't know. I just think he's not all that good.
Let's revisit the Pod Vader plan now, where I'm giving the Jets their second round tender to sign Leon Washington to the New England Patriots. But do you think this acquisition of Tomlinson means the Jets are actually worried about Leon Washington?
I wonder if they're worried from that perspective, and or how healthy is he right now?
Right.
You know, from what I understand, he's not back to being 100% quite yet, and who knows how that rehab's really going. So, yeah, I mean, I would bet there is some concern. I mean, I'm sure they love Sean Green. He looked great upon last viewing, and I think that can skew your perspective a little bit here, too, is, you know, Thomas Jones did the heavy lifting for 14, 15 games, and then Sean Green came into the equation when teams he was playing against and everybody else was a lot more worn down than him, and his fresh legs showed up. And I do think he's talented. I have no problem with him being the number one, but I'm not sure that you're going to see that same guy from day one until the Jets are eliminated from the playoffs. Mm. So you need somebody. I got no problem with that. I'd rather have Thomas Jones. I might even rather spend a fourth-round pick on a guy and use that money elsewhere. I just don't think Tomlinson's all that good anymore.
Mm. Quick slants.
Speaking of running backs that may or may not be that good anymore, the Redskins signed running back Larry Johnson. Not content with just one aging, opinionated running back, the Redskins added a second one Friday night when they signed Larry Johnson to a three-year incentive-laden contract. His deal has a base value of $3.5 million, but he could make as much as $12 million if he meets certain incentives. He did get a note of support from his former head coach in Dick Vermeil. I don't know. What do you think of this move?
Yeah, you know what? My editors got in touch with me yesterday. They want me to write an article or two for the NFC East blog, and this was one of the things we picked. Turned it in last night. And I think I had started the whole article by saying, well, now the Redskins have two washed up over the hill running backs, you know, and no offensive line. I don't get it. My thoughts are Shanahan probably remembers playing against Larry Johnson in Chiefs Broncos games back when he was Larry Johnson. And I haven't seen that back in a long time. You know, he runs high. He's taken an awful lot of punishment. He goes back to that rule of 370, you know, I'm sure you've heard about that, where you get 370 carries and your career goes right down the toilet from there. What really happened to him? He never really rebounded after that. Beat his body up. He doesn't get out of the way of people anywhere like he used to. Doesn't make people miss. I don't get it. I'm not a fan of him or Portis anymore. I think they're both washed up. But I also kind of gave the caveat of Shanahan has a great track record of finding fifth-round runners, you know, something like that, that I'm sure they're going to draft somebody to add to the equation, and maybe that guy can come in mid-season and pick up the slack if they use their other resources on Russell Okung or, you know, more linemen and that type of thing.
Right.
Or you look at the project as, hey, we're not that far. We're pretty far away yet. I'm Mike Shanahan. I'm taking over this team. We're pretty far away. And if I'm building an offense, the last piece I want is that stud running back. So let's let Portis and Larry Johnson get their bodies beat up for a year, and next year I'll go get my stud. And in the meantime, I'll build a line, I'll build a passing game, and instead of beating up my stud workhorse for this year, let's get another year out of that guy and go that direction. But I'm not sure there's ever a good reason to bring in a washed-up you know, guy with off-the-field problems who doesn't help you in the passing game or special teams.
The Redskins also signed quarterback Rex Grossman. Is he the starter or is he the backup?
He might be third string if they draft a guy. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think he can compete with Jason Campbell. I think Jason Campbell's a far better quarterback than Rex Grossman. Let's leave it at that.
Quick slant.
Let's talk about the Bills real quickly. They did some moves on defense, signing defensive end Dwan Edwards to a four-year deal, potentially worth close to $18 million. They also agreed to a contract with linebacker Andre Davis, formerly of the Browns.
I've been very critical of the Bills organization, but I really like both of these moves. They both fit the same mold. They're old school, tough, play the game hard, a lot of experience in a 3-4, which is where Buffalo's going to. I was kind of shocked that Andre Davis got released. I thought he played pretty well last year, and he's more of that hammer inside linebacker. He's not the biggest guy around for that role, but he's pretty effective, and he'll throw his body around. And Edwards, he's more of an end than a nose, and nose is their bigger need. But they're both good run stuffers, and that's what Buffalo needs. They're good 3-4 front seven players.
All right. Quick slants. We had some other quick signings to discuss. The Dolphins signed guard Richie Incognito.
Yeah, he was rumored to go a couple different places. Immensely talented, immensely troubled on and off the field. I mean, he takes a ton of penalties, had all kinds of issues at Nebraska coming out, and he really hasn't gotten away from that. But, you know, that's a good culture in Miami. You know, the head coach Sperano is an O-line guy, and you know, maybe he gets a hold of him and turns him into the player that he's capable of being. He's a very talented young man.
Titans signed defensive end Jason Babin, according to ESPN NFL insider Adam Schefter, and they agreed with cornerback Rod Hood.
Yeah, they need the corner depth. You know, obviously, they were exposed very badly at the beginning of last season when Finnegan got hurt and some of their other corners. I don't think this alleviates that need, though. It certainly wouldn't shock me if one of their first two picks was a corner. And really the same thing's true with defensive end. That was also a big need. Babin's a former first-round pick, very, very talented. Never really fit in as a 3-4 outside linebacker, but he's too small for a defensive end, where he's kind of that true tweener that isn't either. So maybe they get some pass rush production out of him on third downs, but I don't see him as an every-down player or a difference maker.
The Eagles did agree to a two-year deal with defensive back Marlon Jackson, and according to ESPN NFL insider Adam Schefter, they have signed running back Mike Bell to a one-year offer sheet. Mike Bell is a restricted free agent.
I love the Jackson pickup. I think he's a very good player, big physical corner that they're projecting to free safety, which is the logical progression for him. The question I have, and I don't know the answer to, is, you know, how banged up are you? I mean, there's a reason that Indy let him go, and that surprised me when it happened, but the immediate red flag was, boy, he's not healthy. You know, they have a big need at free safety, but he's tough, he's smart. I think he can make that transition switch. Even when he came out of school, there was a lot of talk. Is he a big corner, big cover two type corner, which Indy picked him as, or is he going to be a free safety? And that's a logical progression in his career, especially coming off an injury if he isn't quite as quick and fast as he used to be. Bell's fine. I think he's a little bit bigger name than he is true production-wise because of the team he came from. In the fantasy football world, he got in the end zone quite a bit, so a lot of people out there know who he is. He runs very hard. I respect the way he comes to play every week. He's a true banger, but he's not special at all. He's a straight-ahead guy that initiates contact, and in a way, that's what the Eagles need. They could use some more physicality.
The Chiefs signed guard Ryan Lijah. They also signed wide receiver Jeremy Urban.
Urban's more or less a non-factor. He's a Cardinal that the head coach obviously is very familiar with, and maybe he makes a team because of that familiarity. I like Lijah, though. They signed Wegman last week as a over-the-hill type center, where Lijah's a little more in his prime. Another guy that I was sort of shocked got let go. I think he'll start immediately for them. And even if one of those two guys kind of hits, and I think Lojo's the better chance, it could make great strides on a bad offensive line.
Steelers signed linebacker Larry Foote back to the team.
Yeah, this one's sort of twofold. Is, you know, right now, James Ferrier's the heavier run take on inside linebacker, and Timmons is the run and hit guy. You know, that's them in a nutshell. But Foote can do both. He's not either, to be honest with you, but he's not neither either. Yeah, not sure how that came out. But Foote used to start next to Ferrier as a run and hit guy. Isn't really as athletic as you want at that spot. You know, he's not a Mayo or a Timmons, but he's also a veteran and he's tough, and he could back up both positions. Timmons has been a bit of a liability with his ability to take on the run, and Foote would be better in that capacity on early downs. And Ferrier's getting up in age, so Foote could be his replacement. And you know, you play on the Lions last year, you don't get a lot of publicity, but Foote played pretty well for them. So I like this signing.
The Bengals agree with wide receiver Antonio Bryant, not Terrell Owens.
That's the right move to me. Between the two of them, once again, you're playing with fire. You know, that meeting room with Matt Jones, 85 and AB is going to be crazy if they can't get them the ball consistently. I'm familiar with Antonio. That was at Pitt with them. I was with the Browns with them. He's exceptionally talented. He's very, very competitive. He wants to win. He wants to be great, but he's volatile. I mean, when things don't go well, he explodes, and, you know, it's a lot like 85. So it's a extremely combustible situation, but it was a massive need, too. That passing game was really a problem last year. They only had one guy. Antonio could possibly pass 85 as the number one guy on the team. He's that type of guy. Or he could completely fizzle out. But if they don't protect better, if they don't throw the ball better and aren't able to get both these guys the ball, you can see problems.
The Ravens agreed with wide receiver Derek Mason, who actually retired last season, came out of retirement. But interesting that he's coming back for another season with the Ravens.
Yeah, this is Joe Flacco's safety blanket. I mean, this is his whoopee. You know, he loves Mason almost to a fault. You bring in Bolden, and he's a very similar receiver, although I think he's an upgrade to Mason. Neither one's a field stretcher. They're both true possession guys. Bolden's bigger, stronger, better after the catch, younger. But why not add Mason in an uncapped year? You know, the passing game needs help. He's familiar. Your young quarterback certainly trusts him. He can move the chains. He knows the division. I got no problem with this. And maybe you get something out of Dante Stallworth as your bomb threat, or maybe you still even use an early pick on the receiver position because you're not young there, but you're much improved.
The Seahawks signed tight end Chris Baker.
I'm going to say this about that.
Now, many of the fans of the show and the Fantasy Focus know that I touted Chris Baker as being the potential starter for the Patriots last season and would score at least 8 touchdowns, which he clearly did not come anywhere near to doing. But he is a good blocker, and I don't understand what the Patriots are doing with their tight end position right now as they let Ben Watson go. But the draft does have depth at tight end, apparently in the second round, and the Patriots have 3 second-round picks.
Yeah, this one sort of surprised me that they didn't bring him back, though, because he is a solid know what you're going to get two-way tight end who isn't dynamic as a pass catcher, but he's a solid blocker. I thought you summed it up well. You know, who the Patriots have on their roster right now? That's
no one.
A zero, right? Are they just going to eliminate that?
They've
position?
Got no one. They got no one of no
any sort of pedigree.
They sort of played. You know, when they went big, you know, in their jumbo alignment, they tended to use an extra offensive tackle, you know, where you would play a tight end.
Use Vollmer or one of those guys.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm not maybe they are eliminating the tight end from their offense completely, which, frankly, I don't have a problem with. Because, again, when you have a Wes Welker and you have a Julian Edelman, I mean, those are the catches that you want the tight end to sort of take up for you.
Over the middle slot,
right,
get it out quick,
right,
let him run after the catch.
So I don't necessarily need a tight end to fill that role. What I do need a tight end is to help out Matt Light, who is aging on that left-hand side,
exactly,
to help out Nick Kayser if he ends up keeping the right tackle job, although I think Sebastian Vollmer may overtake him. You know, I need that tight end to help out in the blocking game. And Chris Baker certainly could fill that role.
Yeah, maybe they are changing things slightly schematically where they're not going to stress the tight end at all, and maybe they are going to play more 6 offensive line situations. You see a lot of teams this past year moving more and more that way. It's rarely talked about, but that is a trend in the league right now, is you're seeing more 6 offensive line sets. You know, I like having Edelman on the field and Welker, but neither one of them, like you alluded to, is 250 pounds and can help, you know, pass rush against, you know, Pace or some of the guys in the division. So we'll see. I'm sure they'll draft somebody. It is a good draft at the top, you know, second, third round. I think you can get good value at that position. But I think it's a good signing for Seattle, too. I mean, John Carlson's probably their best, maybe their best offensive player right now, and which is a little sad. But they need to stress him a little more, maybe detach him a little bit, use two tight end sets to free him up. So I'd like to pick up by them.
Quick slants.
3 releases to address real quickly. The Eagles released offensive lineman Sean Andrews. The Bears released cornerback Nathan Vasher. And the Raiders cut defensive tackle Gerard Warren, who was due a huge roster bonus. Any of those 3 an impact player for another team?
Maybe Andrews. I mean, I think Andrews, on top of his game, is one of the best offensive linemen in this league. he's been very troubled off the field with I guess, depression issues. Am I right on that?
Yes.
I knew there was something going on that was a little, you know, outside the realm of football, and he's had some injuries. So there must be some reason they're allowing him to walk, and it has to be off the field. So that's something I don't know the answer to. But when he's right, he's a bad dude. And they have his brother on the team. I mean, they had these guys as going to be the starting right tackle and starting right guard, and that could have been as good of a right side of the line as you can get. I mean, they're extremely talented. They're great size. There must be more to the story, and I don't know all the details, but I'm assuming he has issues right now. Vasher, his play's really fallen off since early in his years. He's more of a quick than fast guy. He's not that big. He's been banged up a lot. I think he's a little bit bigger name than his production and play really indicate at this stage of his career. And Gerard Warren just isn't worth that money. You know, he's become a dime a dozen average defensive tackle who will probably land somewhere else, but is somebody you're always going to look to replace. His effort goes up and down. And just isn't worth that money.
Quick slants.
Last note, and I only bring it up because his pro day was yesterday, but the Jaguars conducted a poll with their season ticket holders who have told them, do not draft Tim Tebow. Tim Tebow's pro day was yesterday. I haven't read much about it, but I did hear Todd McShay, talk about it on SportsCenter and said teams that like Tebow now like Tebow more and can justify drafting him in the second round. And teams that didn't like Tebow aren't going to like him any better and aren't going to draft.
You saw clips of it on TV. I wasn't at the pro day, and I don't pretend to be on top of that 100%. But obviously his motions changed quite a bit in the last 6 weeks. The ball is not dipping down below his waist. He's keeping it pretty high. But you could tell he was also very mechanical about it too, very conscious about making sure every throw was what they wanted to see. And I still think it's going to be a very long transition muscle memory wise. You know, when people are diving around you and the chips are down, it's game time. I bet that he goes back to those old ways. I mean, he's been doing that. He's been throwing the football the same way probably since he was 4, 5, 6 years old. And the change in 6 weeks is impressive. If I was a talent evaluator of him, saying that's impressive that he's willing to do the work, and he did make some big strides in a short amount of time, but I'm betting that he goes back to, you know, he has some lapses, so to speak. And the ideal situation for me with Tebow is I want to see him go to a team that already has an established starter. I don't want him getting forced into the mix whenever he goes to a team like Jacksonville or, you know, and they're 4-6, and everyone's clamoring for him to get on the field. I want him to go to your Patriots. You know, I want him to go somewhere that no one is going to think that he has a chance to start, that he can have a redshirt year or two, and let him be that conscientious guy and work hard. Because once the ball comes out of his hands, he throws the ball pretty well. But that release is a real problem. You can't dip it that low. Can he consistently stay with what he showed yesterday? You know, so that's a lot of questions. And I heard somebody actually talk about the Jaguars season ticket holder poll. That's all well and good, but the people you really need to poll are the people who aren't going to the games. You already have those guys.
That's true.
You know? You need to find out the general public's thought. And I bet they'd be a little more apt to say, yeah, bring in Tim Tebow.
All right, we've been going long here, but why don't we answer a few emails here?
All right.
Welcome. Mailbox number, please.
Your emails with your questions.
Computer, any messages for me?
The Audibles.
First message.
Email sent to footballtoday@espnradio.com. This first one comes to us from Chris. Says, hope you're feeling better to JG. Offense has been loaded with free agency news and whatnot. However, I hope you haven't forgotten a great suggestion by one of your listeners to explain to us how team's philosophy works. For example, the 3-4 versus the 4-3, West Coast offenses, etc. We'll eagerly wait every Thursday for your podcast. Well, Chris, I wanted to address that since it's more of a producer planning sort of question and just say that there is a lot of news right now. These sort of topics will be best addressed post-draft. Up until the draft, though, I think we're going to have way too much news to get into these sort of conversations about the 3-4 and the 4-3. Wouldn't you agree with that, Matt?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, there is that month or so when all the talent evaluators everyone football-related is on vacation, more or less. And that would be a great time for me to you know, we can start talking about generalities of the game.
Definitely. This one comes to us from Day in Maryland. He's a chronic emailer. We often hear of how a team, quote, identified a player that they really wanted and, quote, went after him hard. For example, the Lions identified Kyle VandenBosch as a player they wanted to acquire. So Jim Schwartz was on VandenBosch's doorstep at 12:01 a.m. on the first day of free agency. What happens if there's more than one team that wants to go after a player in that manner? Will teams camp outside on a player's lawn like they're trying to get tickets to a Maryland versus Duke game? Fear the turtle? Is there a paper, rock, scissors square off to see who gets first dibs? Will the coaches run the 40 against each other or see who can throw up 225 pounds the most? In all seriousness, how do they determine who speaks to the player first?
I have no idea. I would imagine it's up to the player. You know,
it's true. I've never heard of, like, two opposing teams camped out at a guy's doorstep. There's usually just one team there.
Yeah, you hear these things actually a lot more in the recruiting world, you know, because everybody's recruiting in, you know, specific high school players, and there's so many colleges, and they all want the same guys, and there's only certain weeks that you can be on the road, and, you know, that a lot of them are camping out trying to get in touch with these guys at different places. So, I don't know. If a bunch of teams came knocking at my door right now saying, Matt, I want you to be my GM, well, I'd look out there and say, who's the best one? Why don't you come in first? I mean, if it was the Raiders, I'd say get in the back of the line. Buffalo, you can wait a little while. Hey, Steelers, New England, right, come on in. I don't know. If somebody comes to your house, it's up to you.
That's very true. But I also think this sort of lends to the idea that, well, you're not supposed to talk to players before the free agency period begins. There's clearly some sort of discussion happening in the background.
Yeah. Maybe they don't actually speak face-to-face or on the phone or via text. But
right.
I know somebody who knows somebody who can get to Kyle VandenBosch.
Correct.
Especially if they're buddies. I mean, a lot of these coaches, you know, lived near those players or in the off season had a barbecue with Kyle VandenBosch. You know, I mean, they're friends. Their wives might be friends.
That's interesting. Yes, Coach Schwartz's wife just happened to be at this same Tupperware party.
Yeah, they went shopping together. They went to Jamaica together. You know, whatever.
They went to Jamaica together. yeah, I don't know you, but what do you think of a vacation in Jamaica? Let's just talk, woman to woman. The Bucks co-superfan Aaron Robinson has written in, says the Bucks haven't done squat in free agency thus far, adding only a backup linebacker, letting Antonio Bryant walk, and trading for yet another number three receiver in Reggie Brown. The team is currently tied for the lowest payroll in the NFL and is certainly positioning itself for their whopping 10 draft picks, three of which fall in the top 42. With everyone assuming that the Bucks will draft one of the two big defensive tackles with the first pick, assuming the Rams do draft Sam Bradford, and considering quarterback Josh Freeman's status as face of the franchise for the next 10 to 12 years, clearly the Bucks need to add a solid number one receiver. Do you guys see the Bucks pursuing Brandon Marshall or making any big moves in that regard? My answer to that in real quick terms, no. There's talk of them drafting a receiver in the second round, but considering the Freeman's development is the number one priority, is it realistic to expect there to be an answer to the receiver dilemma hanging around the second round, considering the slow transition many college receivers make to the NFL? I never thought I'd say this, but I'm almost in favor of bringing in T.O. for a year just to have someone who draws DBs their way, freeing up some open looks for Kellen Winslow and Sammy Strader. Thoughts?
You know what? It drives me crazy whenever you put the onus of an offense on such a young and expensive and talented signal caller as a franchise first-round pick without providing them weapons. You know, they have one. They have Winslow. Mm-hmm. They need to do absolutely must-find receivers, and that goes back to a year ago. I mean, remember whenever free agency opened, you know, more than a year ago, they were the team with the most cap room. They were supposedly involved with Haynesworth and all these big-name guys. Mm-hmm. They failed to get anything done on any level last year in free agency. And that, to me, was unexcusable as ever because they had the most cap room to play with. They had the most cards in their hand, and they couldn't get anything done. And now, without a cap year, there wasn't a whole lot of people out there that they seemed interested in, and, you know, maybe they're not the most attractive team to go to right now. But you've also heard this rumor, and you may not have heard this one yet, is supposedly Denver's interested, and this is a rumor, that Denver's interested in giving up a first-round pick and Marshall to move to that number three spot.
Man.
That I would consider, but I would probably turn down. But if I was them, I would certainly get in the Brandon Marshall situation. Because maybe don't give that third pick up, because things look like they really fell into your lap now. I mean, assuming Bradford goes one, you're going to get a stud D tackle at three, where a couple weeks ago you had to think, boy, Sue and McCoy are going to be off the board. Now what do I do? You know, I don't love a receiver here. Do I take Barry that high? You know, you already got Tanner Jackson at safety. So I think the draft is really set up well for them, assuming Bradford does go one, which I think is pretty safe right now. Well, I think you jump on that D-tackle, but, boy, that 36 pick or so might be able to yield you Brandon Marshall with a future consideration or something along those lines. I don't think it's too far-fetched to still be in the Brandon Marshall conversation.
Well, I only think it's far-fetched in the fact that I have heard rumors about the Tampa Bay ownership and being sort of frugal.
Sure.
And he does bring up the fact that they are now near the bottom in terms of payroll in a year in which being at the bottom in terms of payroll, you can be as far, you don't have to pay anybody anything.
Sure.
And with a lockout coming up, and knowing that the Tampa Bay ownership is also involved with Manchester United, I believe, in England, and how frugal they are with money, I don't think that they're going to try and sign the third pick in the draft and Brandon Marshall, because that's going to increase payroll tremendously.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yeah, I don't know what the rich man who signs the checks is saying to his employees. I don't know what that conversation is, but viewing it from a football standpoint, I think they have enough in their hand to leave this draft with McCoy and Marshall, and that would be great.
No, I clearly agree with that. From a pure football standpoint, getting those players is exactly what they need.
Yeah.
Will they do that, though?
They can't go into next year throwing to Clayton and Strotter and now Reggie Brown. I mean, that's criminal.
Mm, well.
But in the second round, you might get a...
Prepare for criminal, Tampa Bay. Another quick question here. Well, quick maybe, depending on what point of view you look at it. This is from David in England. He's a Packers fan. But he says, I've been watching the NFL for 30 years and have seen the collective effect of rule changes to open up the passing game and protect the quarterback. This year I've felt more than ever that a top 10 quarterback working behind an even average offensive line is capable of avoiding sacks and completing passes at will, to the point that they can be beaten only by their own mistakes, not by any defensive scheme. Breeze and Manning in the Super Bowl, Favre, Kurt Warner, Brady when healthy, Roethlisberger, even my man Aaron Rodgers. All of them were capable of being unstoppable, not only every once in a while, but for some of them, almost every game they played. Does this change the dynamic for defenses? If there's no tactical adjustment that can stop these passers, does it make taking a roughing the passer penalty a more attractive option? 15 yards is a big penalty, but it's not so big if the passer is throwing for 400 plus yards. In fact, it starts to look like a small penalty given the alternative. Say the penalty only gets called 50% of the time, and the upside is you break the quarterback's rhythm, slow them with an injury, or knock them out of the game altogether, and if you get to the backup, you probably win the game. So is roughing the passer going to become a penalty of necessity? If I'm a defensive coordinator, I'm thinking that it may be the best and only thing I can do to make a difference. David, you're thinking in very evil ways, but at the same time, he sort of brings up a point. Could all these rules that they've made to protect the quarterback actually be the law of unintended consequences at work?
First time I've ever thought of it, that's for sure. And yeah, this is like Dr. Evil over there wringing his hands, though, and I kind of like it. I mean, if you're a defensive coordinator and it's week 15 and if you don't make the playoffs, you're going to get fired and you and your kids are going to have to move, and you might say, why don't you just, you know, drill Roethlisberger and take the 15, you know, hit Aaron Rodgers. I guess there is some logic to that, and maybe that is the next diabolical progression in all this, because one thing you've always noticed in football is everything goes in cycles. And whenever offenses, you know, come up with something with a West Coast scheme or something new and innovative, the defenses counter with something. I hope it isn't, let's try to break the quarterback's knees.
Yeah, that would be.
But you could see where 15 yards isn't all that terrible of a solution if you can take a great quarterback out for the second half.
And there were quarterbacks like Kurt Warner You know, besides the fact that he was, you know, he did suffer some injuries there towards the end of his career, but would get kind of shaky the more hits that he took.
Oh, most do.
So, you know, if you're doing it on purpose, if you're being the Oakland Raiders of old, and you're just taking penalties to take them.
Yeah, but there's more to it, too. I mean, there's going to be fines.
There'd be fines. I'm sure there'd be suspensions.
Yeah.
You're going to get thrown out of games. I don't know. It's something to consider and something to watch for sure. A couple quick ones. Josh reminds us that the Colts beat the Bears in a monsoon in 2006. You might remember I said I wanted to see an outdoor team take on a dome team in Miami this year. And
monsoon might be a strong word for that Super Bowl.
But it did rain.
It rained.
And it was one of the first times we've ever had sort of, you know, I don't know if I'd call them sloppy conditions, but they weren't ideal conditions.
Not quite a monsoon.
Still, I think an outdoor team in the snow will do much better than an indoor team in the snow, or the cold for that matter.
Yeah.
And Brandon in Cincinnati, referring to me, I don't know what's more annoying, Ocho Cinco's misunderstanding of the Spanish numerical system, or hearing you mispronounce 85's last name. It's not Ocho Cinco for Pete's sake, it's Ocho Cinco. Brandon, for a man who changed his name to a number, I don't think the pronunciation is all that important.
I'm with you, brother.
That's going to do it for today's edition of Football Today. I am your host, producer Jay Soderberg, Pod Vader, whatever you want to call me. Don't call me late for dinner. Horrible joke, I know, but I had to go there.
That was brutal.
And I'm joined with your guest host, Matt Williamson, on the phone, who doesn't try to make horrible jokes.
All righty. It was good stuff, as always.
Good show. Jam-packed. We'll see you next week. We'll have some more guests coming up. We've got lots of things planned for you in the next few weeks. Until then, there you have it.
The music provided on today's show is from Mevio's Music Alley, Will Chryski's Metal Mayhem. Check it out at music.mevio.com. For more football talk, be sure to check out Football Tonight, Monday through Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com.